This is the AdNonTech Podcast, conversations about education, technology, and culture, with Dr. Doug Reed and Dr. Matt Stranick. Thank you for joining us.
My name is Dr. Doug Reed, and I am located in Abigwe, the traditional and unceded territory of the Mi'kmaq people.
My name is Dr. Matthew Stranick, and I am on Treaty No. 8 territory, the traditional meeting grounds and gathering places of our First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples. Hello, everybody. It has been a couple of months, summer months, let's be real. And this is episode 62 of the AdNonTech podcast. Not that you'd know from my background, my perhaps jarring somewhat background gif, I am located in, and I'm very as surprised as anybody to be kind of describing it this way. I'm in dynamic, vibrant, international, and academically and professionally captivating Fort McMurray, Alberta, the land of pickup trucks and like the leading edge of capitalism and internationalization in contemporary Canadian economy. Wouldn't have thunk it, but here we sit. Here I sit. And as ever, the inestimable Dr. Doug Reed, always a pleasure. We were just kind of getting caught up a bit, as Maritimers are wont to do. That's W-O-N-T, you know, for those of you who are parsing the thesaurus-ish aspect of that. Above and beyond what we were just kind of chit-chatting about there, pal, I mean, how's it been going? What's the weather situation? I'm on the opposite side of the country again, right? So I'm not, like, living in the same, environmental kind of biome or whatnot. What's with the hither and yon, my friend?
We got hit by a ton of rain yesterday. It basically rained all day, and it was hard rain. It was nice and torrential.
Hard rain is going to fall, as per Bob Dylan, and it sounds like it did. So I'll be dang, man. Gardening, no woodwork projects outside or whatnot, I suppose, given such circumstances. You did manage to take the doggos out for their typical walk, even?
Nope.
Not even.
With this rain, the barometric pressure shift that happened just hammered me. I get migraines on occasion, and yesterday I got one. So I felt sorry for myself and laid on the couch, and they snuggled with me most of the day. So that's
exactly why people have those little, I don't know, it's almost like having a toddler. I mean, I know you don't have kids, right? But I mean, I've had human kids and I've had a dog in my life. And honestly, you know, the dogs have as much requirement as like a little toddler human, right? But this is why you have them, right? For the snuggles, for the positive vibes, for the,
absolutely,
tactile and emotional and mental supports of having a dog, basically. I freaking love dogs. I can't wait till I can actually own a dog here in Alberta. Might be a while, but.
And you see, I don't own dogs. Have you ever heard of the Hawaiian term haku?
No, but I like it already.
In Hawaiian, apparently nobody owns dogs. You are a beloved attendant, or you are a guardian. So
a custodian of the dog. That's
yes.
Dope.
A custodian of the well-being of an important soul. That's how I like to look at it.
My pop culture and grunge music associations are hardwired just ridiculously so. As you were describing that lovely concept and cultural practice, my mind immediately latched on to the 1992 A&M Records release, Temple of the Dog, featuring members of Soundgarden and Pearl Jam prior to them achieving huge, you know, global level success such as they did. It was before the first Pearl Jam record came out, and it was actually the members of those musicians sort of celebrating, remembering the life of their a singer who had passed. They were from Andrew Wood from Mother Love Bone, who played with the musicians who were at Pearl Jam prior to becoming Pearl Jam. And it was only in the wake of his passing from a drug overdose at age 23 or something, prolonged 3-4 day in the hospital kind of ordeal. After his passing, the principals of Pearl Jam had Eddie Vedder come up from San Diego, I want to say, Northern California, and so then achieving global superstar status, which they're still recording and touring today, that was like their first record, Temple of the Dog, and it was an act of mourning for a singer, right? So I think that's kind of a pop culture, music, bit of a digression on your very lovely concept there, my friend. Now that we properly had the icebreaker, I've done actually for the second time. You know about the ISW training, Doug? Have you heard about the ISW training as a teaching learning certification thingy? I don't know if you ever. No. Nope. Okay. Well, it's a thing, and so I'm now sort of meta aware a bit more of how we're using the time, and so icebreaker achieved. Doug, what do we even talk about with this episode, my friend?
Well, the way I wanted to start season 3 of the podcast, because that's what I consider this is, right? We take the summers off a bit and then move on. So I see this as the start of season 3. And we're talking about starting points for a new year. And since we're starting season 3, we're starting new roles, because I know you're going to have a new introduction and a new land acknowledgement or territorial acknowledgement, because
I did that up this morning, as a matter of fact, prior to checking in with you. So,
yeah. So I wanted to talk about starting points for the new school year.
Awesome.
Because the new school year has just started, and all those things that happen. And there's so many things that happen that people aren't aware of. Like, I was sick yesterday because all the students swarmed campus and I caught something. On top of the migraine, I caught whatever, some bug from somebody. So I just wanted to head in that direction. And I know you're going to have some stories because you've started your new role a couple of weeks ago.
That I certainly did, pal. This is highly legit. And I mean, I know that, like, not everybody has spent, I tried to count at one point, and, 12 years of public education. I spent 5 years, actually, to achieve my Bachelor of Arts degree. I kind of futzed around, and, you know, it took me 5 years. So we're at 17 years, 1 year B.Ed., 2 years to do my master's. I mean, like, I'm literally freaking losing count for the amount of years that I've spent in school. And so for me, the fall has always just had this kind of, you know, like quasi-productive, quasi-nostalgic. It's, you know, because as much as I sort of was not suited to large amounts of my high school years and the like, I mean, I've been good enough at it and successful enough at it that somehow I'm now, you know, with the terminal degree and teaching adults how to do, you know, certain things or, you know, help facilitate that. So somewhere along the line, school has agreed with me. And so I'm always chuffed. I'm always pleased to do sort of I think we did this one of these last year or at another point in the show where it was like, yeah, new school year. And I think actually you know, we recorded our first episode of this like 2 years ago, or in September. It was in the month of September, I think, right? So
September the 9th, yeah.
I'll be double dang. Look at you with the facts and the stats. Excellento. So happy 2 year anniversary of the show, I suppose. Gosh dang, come to think of it. May as well. So, yeah, man, you got anything else before we start diving into a rather substantial reference here? I see you with Lieberman and Miller.
From 1978, yeah.
That was where I was born. Whoa, almost a half century ago. We're going back in the way back machine for that one, bro.
Yeah, I pulled these out on purpose.
That's dope.
I wanted it to be old.
Very cool.
So we've got social realities of teaching. And one thing that people don't seem to understand is, yes, educators get the summer off because educators need the summer off.
Oh, boy.
And that time off is a time off because they start ramping up. They start preparing for whatever's coming next. They start getting ready for the next year.
And coffee fuels the educational endeavor, my friends, at all levels. Yeah.
And that's it, right? And teachers have a central contradiction. Lieberman and Miller talk about that, where they have to say, okay, you've got to have a style that's individual and it's personal, but you've also got two missions. You've got a cognitive mission, and then you have an affective mission. And the cognitive mission is about developing skills to make sure that the students learn. And the affective mission is somehow you also have to motivate the students and arouse their interest and engage them on personal levels. And that's not easy. That's hard.
Remembering their names can be tough. I'm not going to lie. I'm straight with it. I'm like, students, it's going to take me like a while. Like, I'm going to know your faces. I'm going to know your issues when you speak to me. But there's certain aspects of this that are just, you know, fair warning, I figure. And then at least, you know, like, well, at least he's being honest. Like, yeah, no doubt. Right. So, they want you to be all this and a bag of chips is what they want. That's kind of an interesting, you know, making sure you're reserving the space to do, like, mentally to do your best work is something that I have, now that I'm back in the primary teaching role again for the first time in like almost 10 years. It's been 9.5 years since I was, you know, the primary thing for my job was being in a classroom with students. And so, like, just ramping up for this experience, I've had to be like, okay, during the week, I have nothing, you know, I don't do podcast stuff. I don't do anything. I'm just saving my mental and creative space for what's going on, you know, with my role. And then the weekends, that's, again, sort of like I'm going to bifurcate and have that completely dedicated to the podcast stuff and, you know, whatever other creative, you know, miscellany kind of stuff I get into. So, but like the weeks are 100% right now for the students. Because like, if I don't do that, like, I just know that there's rabbit holes for my energy and my time just waiting for me out there. And so I think, I don't know if that necessarily aligns or speaks to the reading here, but that's kind of what's putting me in the mind of my friend.
Yeah. And I picked this on purpose for that very reason. So we could have that conversation.
Yeah.
Because you're talking about just getting started and getting to know the students and making sure you know what curriculum that you need to address with them and that they have to engage with. But marking hasn't even happened yet. Like,
it's gonna. I got stuff from all of them last week where it's, I got 1 week. That's the thing too. It's like, you know, again, just to speak to, you know, the effective aspect of it. I mean, you really, you know, as a teacher, you start out with all the credibility in the world. You know, you're starting out that first day with all the credibility in the world. And a lot of, you know, people don't necessarily realize, you know, the power of that moment. So it's really just things like, okay, are you going to respond to students' emails in a timely fashion? Are you going to, you know, be there exactly during your office hours when they show up? Are you going to make the time for them if they show up 10 minutes before your class and you're on your way to your class to talk to them anyway? It's this kind of thing where you know, students are going to be sort of testing what your boundaries even are, you know, and if you're being sensible about it, if you're being thoughtful about it, you'll anticipate that. And you'll sort of, you know, build that into your routine. Again, man, I feel like I'm going off here, so I'll just sort of let that sit. But
you just described the affective mission that Lieberman and Miller talk about, right? It's how do you connect with them? You're not making friends with them, but it's motivate them, engage them, and right? So, how to arouse their interest, how to help them however you can.
And and this is what I keep thinking, like my, you know, with the, as we talked about the community of inquiry framework, right? And for me, I mean, that's just like, I spent so long with it for my doctorate that it's just, you know, my go-to sort of conceptual model, as it were. And what I keep finding myself thinking and actually speaking to in the classes is before the ad drop date, the first couple of weeks are really about social presence, such that people feel comfortable, the students and myself as a group, we all feel comfortable to disclose such that learning can then, the cognitive stuff can actually, you know, happen without any inhibition due to people not feeling totally comfortable or properly situated within the learning environment, really. So to that end, I'm making use of discussion forums in the online thing, plus, you know, in-person stuff to reinforce that as well. So again, it's just sort of taking the effective stuff and actually making it part of the curriculum, right? Making it part of intentionally the curriculum. Like, you know, part of my thing in class is like, have people been putting into the forums? Because you're expected to, you need to. Part of my thing tomorrow on Monday is that I'm going to be going into the forums myself and, you know, spending an hour, 40 minutes, whatever, in each of my four classes, just, you know, chiming in. Because, again, I think that's an investment that will, that kind of a personal engagement where I'm sort of modeling the desired behavior that I'm sort of speaking to that I expect of them, right? It's like, I can't tell them, you better be engaged in the online thing and in class. Like what? Like what if I, like if they don't see me doing anything more than posting announcements or updating a document or something in the LMS, then what's the incentive for them to participate, right? Again, man, I'm rambling like a rambling man. So I'll just
You jump to the cognitive side that this article talks about, that central, right, contradiction that you got to deal with. Like you have to take your skills, make sure you address this content, whatever it happens to be, and how do you do it, right? It's those skills. And I feel bad. I remember being a first-year teacher. I remember being a first-year prof. I remember that. And that's why I always try to help however I can, because that's not easy. That is hard.
E-learning to the rescue, man. I swear, I'm not going to put us down another tangent before we get to the next reference here. But I will say that, you know, I've been straight with students. You know, I'm just like, my background for the past 10 years has been curriculum and e-learning and like faculty development, right? More or less, you know, with some variety in there. And so like for me, I'm looking at this, like this literature class, very much also as like a study of it's like a social sciences sort of thing, right? So like I'm actually having them do like learning preferences surveys, you know, and taking that inputs, you know, like anonymous inputs from the surveys, and then in the lecture saying, okay, so among the four classes that form this sort of larger cohort, you know, here's how many people feel comfortable with, you know, English as an academic language. Here's how many people enjoy reading. Here's how many people don't enjoy reading. Here's how many, you know, and so forth. And so, like, it's like, okay, you know, here's how you do a little survey and here's how you speak to the visuals and do a presentation about it, as much as it is, you know, sort of coming up with a group, you know, identity or something through that kind of discussion because of the inputs coming from the students, rather than just sort of jumping into the heavy curriculum. Like, you know, I expect you to have the first novel read by the end of the first 2 weeks of the course. Like, freak that in a nose, man. Like, You know, you can defer the content. The content is scalable. The opportunity at the front, which again, being away from the classroom for 10 years really and coming back into it, now I'm really seeing that, you know, it's like having a just accessible, professional, you know, thing at the front for a while is important. So again, man, I keep saying no more rabbit holes, and yet.
Come on, we haven't had a rabbit hole in 2 months.
Well, we're having a freaking warren of them now. So anyway, my dude, as much as any of that makes sense, I mean,
it makes sense.
So in terms of, I guess I'd be interested to know, Doug, I mean, you've sort of alluded to a lot of administrative processes, and I know we're not going to be talking too much about the job, but I think just, you know, for people in administrative roles, there's a really significant opportunity to affect classroom learning. And I think, you know, there are curricular decisions that are being made, you know, by enlightened, thoughtful managers and, you know, sort of in between the student level and all the way to the rest of the institution that, you know, are meaningful. So, again, I think, you know, it's you know, you're sort of coming at September, you know, from your standpoint, variously, as am I, and as are all the various audience who might be checking out the show, right? Everybody, September is their own, and yet. Dude, that was legit. Oh, man. That deserves an insert on the Camtasia with a thing. Maybe with minions. I don't know, man. That's
so.
Please take it away, my friend. Please just go where we're going from here.
Sure. Two things. One, for the listeners, we have a deal. Matt and I have a deal that if we get caught in certain phrases, the other will just let the person know. And I heard a bunch of you knows, so I just wrote lots of you knows in the chat.
It's been a while. It's been 2 months since we've had this kind of conversation.
Yeah.
I haven't had a conversation for this show for any show for a couple months almost, generally. July, there was an interview. So, all about getting back into the flow and therefore avoiding a time-consuming Camtasia edit. In lieu of a learning moment here, live in the podcast learning environment. Whoa!
And that's one of the interesting things about the topic that I chose, because it is the start of a new year. I see this as the start of a new year. So we had all that chance to relax and change and do whatever we're doing. And oh yeah, that. Got to remember that. Back with the students, back with the audience, back with us. Got to remember that, whatever it happens to be. So, and I want to jump to Egan, call the 1981 article Beginnings, the Orientation of New Teachers, because a lot of what you were discussing, and I know you think it was a rabbit hole, but I don't think it was, because it talks about that relationship that you're building with the students and how you're being the role model and how you're saying we have to do X, Y, and Z, whatever that has to be. Egan talks about the relationship with new educators and talks about how when a teacher signs a contract, there's a dual commitment there. And sometimes it doesn't feel like a dual commitment. The teacher pledges to explicitly state, this is what I'm going to do. And there's also another part that isn't as explicit in what the principal and what the administration and what the employer is going to do and how to help the teacher grow as a person and an educator. So that second part has to happen. And right now I'm in a role that's much more admin. And that's what I'm doing. That's helping with the curriculum. I'm orienting the new faculty. I'm working with them on whatever it happens to be. I'm doing 3 different PD sessions next week on assessment and creating rubrics and how rubrics
awesome. Work. Awesome. Yeah. See, I only could wish that you might be streamcasting them. Streamcasting. I think I just made a new word.
No, that's a word.
Is it streamcasting? Okay.
Yeah, I've heard that before.
So sorry. I wish, I could hope that you might be, you know, if you can put a webcam in that room or something, because I'd be interested, not even just from an educational standpoint, like seeing you do what you do, but like I could actually use that info myself within my new thing, I think. So.
And what I enjoy is I'm getting to work with these new educators, and they're all experts in their fields.
Yes.
And they've now been hired as educators, and this is a whole brave new world for them. So it's, and some of them have inherited material. Some of them have not. And it's, how is this going to work for you and your students, right? And it's that ownership component. And it's, okay, well, what does that mean? Well, I don't know. Then get rid of it. Right? You're the expert in the field. If that doesn't work, get rid of it. And that's what admin is for. So that's the role I'm in now. It's like, how do I help?
Directing folks towards their best version of what they are capable of bringing to the teaching moment, right?
Yeah.
Using your experience, knowledge, access to, you know, resources from within the institution and elsewhere to help provide, you know, support, mental, moral, technological, curricular, effective in various other ways. And again, this is where like there's like the stated job title for roles, stated job description. Thank you, HR departments, for what you do. But then there's sort of this whole sphere of, you don't want to call them soft skills or soft interactions, but other things that are, you know, part and parcel of that, or, you know, stem from and feed into, you know, that description that sort of surround it. And if you're not necessarily hip to those other kind of contextual factors, then, you know, the supports can be there as well as you like, but, you know, they're not going to be utilized, you know, to their best advantage. And I think this is where, you know, the larger culture, not just of the school, but of the community and the community's relationship to the school becomes, you know, pretty important, because that's ultimately where students are sort of the entering from, right? It's the wider area. So anyway, man, everything you described just sounds really legit, and that's kind of what it made me think of. So.
And yeah, it's the funnest part of what I do.
Yeah.
Because in my world, my dharma is to help people learn and have better lives.
Absolutely.
That's what it is. So if I can help these new educators, wicked. That will definitely trickle down to help the students. It just will. And especially
in the wider community, because those students step out into their situation. So like here in Fort Mac, there's an instructor. I won't, you know, mention my new colleague by name or either of them necessarily, but I've been out just in the community, you know, at the bank or the grocery store or whatnot. It's a smaller place. I mean, it's around the size of Fredericton. It's got about 68,000 people here, give or take, plus way more out in the camps. But that's a different story. But like within the city proper, there's about 70,000 people any given time. Not a large city, but not, you know, small by chance at all. And so I can go into, you know, any store for just about any purpose in my general stomping grounds of downtown Fort Mac. And the conversation has come up, well, oh, you work at, you know, Keanu, you must know, you know, so-and-so. So like people who have been at the institution within my role for 7, 5, 12 years, they are known presences out there in the community. And these people who are engaging with are now subsequently into their journey beyond the institution, still remaining in the community. And every one of those people is affecting, you know, they have their own sphere of influence, whether it's a bank teller, you know, a cashier, you know, somebody who you might be seeing in a professional meeting or context or setting. You're aware. And I think smaller communities, I think that's what makes Atlantic Canada so cool. I mean, it either drives you away and drives you insane, or it becomes an aspect of what you like about the place, right? The You know where, you know the faces. You don't necessarily know the names, but just about everywhere you go, there's that semblance of smaller city familiarity. Jesus, it's been a while.
To put a frame of reference around that, yeah. Charlottetown, the capital of PEI, is less than half the size of what you just described as Fort McMurray.
Are you serious? There's fewer than 30,000 or 35,000 or whatever. Fewer.
Yeah.
The birthplace of Confederation, folks.
I think
if remote work arrangements were not being cracked down upon since the downfall of COVID, apparently, where like the federal government, for instance, is recalling most of its work from home staff and things like this, I feel like if there was actually more remote work, such as there were the opportunity for immediately with after and during the pandemic, that way more people would be in the Maritimes. I mean, that's what, in New Brunswick, when I was in St. John, that's what people were saying. They were like, it was all these people from Toronto who left after COVID, and then they bought property, and then and apparently that's one of the factors that's responsible for prices going up in our region. But still, like, if I could do my job somehow, actually, I like Fort Mac. I'd probably stay here because it's close to my kids. But I know a lot of people would be in Charlottetown or wherever. But apparently, the pandemic never happened, and we didn't need any of that work from home stuff, really. So, you know, until next time, I suppose, for that. But
and you've touched upon a good point that is in the Hudson 2012 article.
Awesome.
And it's about schools affect, how can schools support beginning teachers? And I don't think it's just beginning teachers. I think it's teachers new to that school or new to that community. And what they talk about is what are educators looking at? Managing student behavior and creating work-life balance. Oh yeah, I saw that table and it's like, I need to add that into the notes because we're both suckers for tables.
It's lovely.
And I just love the way it presented. And
yeah.
So this table has all these different things that the beginning teachers that they studied talked about with achievements and challenges, right? Securing a position, that's an achievement, right? Student achievements, that's more of a challenge, right? And they work down like working as a team. Getting to work as an educator was seen as an achievement. Nobody found it a challenge in the research that happened. But basically everybody said behavior management was the biggest thing. And it's like, yes, it is. And how much do we cover that in BED programs? Is there a
I this is just me being like this privileged post-secondary educator person who has not been in a K-12 classroom, you know, like for any significant amount of time in my career, to be real. I find behavior management like challenging as a term, you know, like classroom management. I just sort of like, you mean they won't sit in the chair when you want them to sit in the chair? You mean they're like, they're hanging from the rafters of the room? They're like, you know, they're scaling the walls, like they're having the Ramones do a concert in the hallway or what? Like, I don't know. It's sort of what you've been speaking to in terms of just like the effective aspect and the relationship building. It's like, first year teachers, again, as you've been sort of speaking to, like within your professional context and just relative to the show, you're coming in, you don't know like your moves as a teacher. You might be fine on your content, but your moves as a teacher are something that you're consciously thinking about. So it's a little artificial. It's a little herky jerky at first, unless you're exceptionally gifted as being just somebody who's like aware situationally, plus able to sort of speak to content stuff in the moment while, you know, the back of mind is kind of doing the scan of the room, checking for engagement, making the eye contact. I mean, that's the kind of thing where just those like interpersonal skills, I mean, it's sort of like, can you walk and chew gum at the same time, right? Can you think about your content, facilitate the discussion, and move your body, you know, physically around and use those nonverbal cues, which is something like 70% of communication is the nonverbal stuff. having command over that to the point that that becomes an asset rather than like a barrier to get over. So I just feel like maybe if there's more emphasis on the effective, developing the effective dimension, right? Like, you know, think of this as a performance. Think of this as something you're going to have to be standing up, you know, doing the thing in person, physically doing that thing. It's not just an abstract, you know, thing that you can quantify. So, again, yeah. I'm sorry. I just classroom management. That term is just I don't care for it. Just.
And are we helping new educators enough? Like I know in my BED training, there was little. It was important, but there was little. When I was a faculty member in Wollongong, we had a conversation about I was in a meeting and it was who's getting the money? Who's getting the scholarship money, right? Here's the however many applicants. And my list was the exact opposite of other people with power. Like we had to list them from like 1 to 12 or 1 to 15, whatever the number was. And so the person with power listed them. And then it's like, okay, so we're all good? And I'm like, nope. Mine was the exact opposite. And everybody looked at me because I had just got tenure. So I was feeling bulletproof, which was a bad move on my part. But anyway, and he's like, well, what's wrong? Your numbers are wrong. And I said, we're a faculty of education, and everybody you want to give money to is going to be a researcher. They're not going to be educators. Why aren't we giving money to educators who can also do research instead of researchers who research education? And it was that switch. And then I felt like I was getting tarred and feathered and carried out of town on a rail. But after the meeting, six people came to me and said, thank you for saying that. That is the problem with what's going on here right now. And I don't know if they've addressed it and they've changed it and stuff, but let's promote more researchers. And then I looked around and most of the people in the faculty had never been teachers, or they'd had a cup of tea in a classroom, right, for a year or two. And then they went off to be researchers. So they don't know classroom management. They don't know how to manage the learning of all these people. And that gets back to the Lieberman and Miller article where they talk about the cognitive mission. It's how are the skills being developed to make sure that the students learn? And they don't have it. So, of course, they're not going to teach it. So, of course, they're going to find other things that are important. They're going to focus on the other stuff, whatever the other stuff happens to be, which is often their research or what they were taught in school.
Well, and so, we've and this is all extremely timely and important, I think, to mention, you know, for the, you know, beginning of the new season and the beginning of the new academic year. I am really pleased personally that I'm now stepping into working in a college teaching and learning environment after being in universities and the private sector for three roles since the last time I even did this kind of thing. And even with my online stuff, I taught online for a couple of universities. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's just completely a different culture. It's like achievement is sort of valued in terms of what can be quantified. Whereas like the college model, the community college model that I'm, you know, participating in now, it's really like sort of elevating the group and sort of serving the local stakeholders, the local, yeah. You know, it's just the focus there, you know, the practical application, the sort of practical research and hands-on, you know, sort of research and learning that goes on in colleges. I mean, it's just that I've realized now, you know, that aligns more with my outlook and values as an educator. And so while I'm deeply grateful for my time working within faculties of education and with ancillary sort of support roles like at Thompson Rivers and the like, you know, those are all awesome learning opportunities. I just feel like, you know, there's the whole let's cultivate a professional researcher class so that we can get better grants from the federal government, the provincial government, and from the institution. You know, it's like all these institutions, they all are like sort of gunning to either go from like a Division III to a Division II to a Division I, or, you know, they may be trying to go from like a college to a university. Perhaps you have experienced such in a way which belies knowledge. Do you know what I mean? I got one of those little flashy cue cards. It was awesome. Thank you, Skype. Thank you, Dr. Dub. My tirade runneth over, my friend, and it endeth as well. Do you know?
The part of what you said that I really enjoyed was the college level stuff. Because I enjoy working at a college where we have close ties to industry in the local community. Because yeah. I found at post-secondary, other than when I was the university person going to see that student teacher in that school, I didn't spend a whole lot of time there, right? I was in my little ivory tower. It wasn't very ivory, you know, it wasn't a tower, but I was in a cocoon kind of doing my own thing. And just to see the shift, like I enjoyed the college shift away from research. I know research is important, but I like the connection with the students, and I like seeing where they're going. And one of the reasons I grabbed this Hudson article in 2012 was they actually said one of the hardest parts for educators is creating a work-life balance. And that's really hard. Do you remember the movie To Sir with Love? The one that Sidney Poitier won the Oscar for?
No, sorry, missed that one. Is it awesome?
I believe he was the first black man to ever win an Oscar.
Oh, boy.
And it took another 30 or 40 years for the next black man to win an Oscar. Okay. Like, it was, and he was amazing. But I read the book before I saw the movie, because I'm that guy, right? I'm going to go read the book. And he got a job teaching. He had just come to the UK. He got a job teaching. And he brought home marketing, and he brought home planning, and it was so great, because I think it was like in Northern England, right around the time when there was a bunch of union stuff going on in Northern England, and his landlord said, don't you be bringing that work home. You get paid to do it at work, you do it at work, because otherwise they're going to expect you to do it at home all the time. So they didn't say the words work-life balance, but it was work-life balance.
And I don't know anybody in this job who has never struggled with that or in this field. Speaking broadly, regardless of whether you're sort of in the K-12 or post-secondary or corporate or whatever, you know, the widest field of educational endeavor, I have never met anybody who has not struggled with that at some point. I have had it brought up in meetings with supervisors in more than one role. What I feel like for me personally, since you brought up such a timely topic, which I think speaks to, you know, if you're setting out, you want to be in a good way, right? Setting out into your opening year as much as you can. This is exactly why now, after 18 plus years of doing this stuff, after having like just various experiences of like knowing, of like doing the opposite of that, right? Not knowing those boundaries, not knowing myself well enough to sort of take care of myself appropriately, mentally, and so forth. And so like now, like my whole thing is like, how am I going to feel when I'm in the classroom? How am I going to feel when it's good to be back, Doug. I'm very grateful to be getting these little flashy notes.
I'm not doing that to be a jerk. I'm doing that just to...
It's great. It's saving me Camtasia edits. This is dope. I have actually been promoting the show in my English classes, by the way. So this is, you're correcting me, and that's helpful because I could potentially have some of my new colleagues and or students drifting over here. And so we value in the moment feedback, and we value the opportunity to move things forward in such a way that it's organic, as opposed to relying on some feature of the technology to have to kind of do an edit point or whatnot. Let's call them learning points and not edit points or something.
And this is part of our journey as lifelong learners.
Well, it's good to be back. I have missed this kind of thing, my friend. So I don't even really necessarily know what I was talking to a moment ago, but I do appreciate what you sort of put us on with that last reference. So,
and one last thing with lifelong learning, because we were just talking about trying to find the balance and how hard it is in a new position.
Yes.
I had a good friend of mine was working on her doctorate and got to the stage where she had to do her comps, her comprehensive exams that some places make you do. Some do, some don't, whatever. And she literally went to her boyfriend and said, I'll see you in a month. And he's like, what's going on? And it's like, nope, in the next 30 days, I have to write 2 papers that can get published. So I don't have time. I have to get this done. This is more important than everything else in the world. So I'll still be in the house, but I'm going to be over there locked away, and I won't be able to have a conversation with you because I'm only doing this. So through the fact that we've set up systems that for the new people coming in to say, yeah, don't expect work-life balance. It's not happening. It's just, we need to put that in our training material. We need to put that in our orientation material. How do we do it? And this is part of the reason why teachers, especially new teachers, don't last.
Attrition,
like how many people do a year and then say, the heck with this, I'm out of here?
We've talked about this a lot on the show, at various points. I mean, we have yet. Okay, so mid-tangent, I think I recall now where I wanted to go with this. I feel like work-life balance is actually like a topic for a show, just in and of itself. When mental health and well-being, I just feel like you have to look at the whole person. You have to look at the whole context. That's what we're trying to advance with the show. And so if some aspect of you is sort of suffering or, you know, in difficulty, you know, compartmentalizing it, the mind, the psyche isn't like a physical organ. You know, it's not a matter of like you can sort of just power on through that sprained ankle or whatever. It's your personhood. It's your identity. It's the way you engage with the world. So if there's some aspect of your life that is off persistently, like, are you trying to change it or are you doing some kind of workaround, you know, some kind of compartmentalization, which is an inherently false, it's a falsehood, right? And so giving new educators the opportunity to put themselves as a whole into their new role and sort of address their needs as entire individuals. And the same thing with students. I just think that that's a better way to go than blasting them with content the first couple of weeks. You know, you got to write 2 publishable papers in a month. All this ridiculous, can you withstand the rigors of academia? Well, how about you just back off and treat me like a human being with respect, you nerd? You know, anyway, you know, for instance. Good Lord. I'm glad we're back. I'm glad we're back, Doug.
Me too. Now, sure. For me, I want to end on a high note.
Okay.
So I grabbed Thompson 2013 First Year Teacher Survival Guide.
Excellent.
And the quote that I really enjoy, just to try to end positively, is, it's a great feeling to look around your classroom and realize that everybody is learning. Because there is, wow, is that an amazing feeling?
I enjoy the new role, my old new role, my new old role.
Yes.
whatever it is, more than I can say. I realized I've got a week under me at this point, a week plus a couple of days of teaching since the semester properly started. And, I've had the first in-class writing assignment worth 5%, where the students have an hour and a half to write the thing in class. And, you know, not putting, good Lord. But like just seeing the students working on the stuff and kind of puzzling it out, I'm just like, it has been too long since I have been in the physical proximity of this. On Monday, I'm gonna go to my email and there's gonna be 100 Word docs attached to email, and I'm gonna be going through and giving feedback on each of them. Mm-hmm. But the moment that led to that, producing those artifacts of learning, was just legit. And to end on a high note, right? It's a cool thing. If you are privileged enough, and it is a privilege to be an educator, I don't think people get that. I don't think people appreciate that enough about our field. It's like, it's actually a privilege to be a teacher. And there's so much shade cast on the field with poor salaries, overwork, like, you must not have been good enough at anything else. Or, like, what? You couldn't handle a real academic role? It's like, forget all that nonsense. Forget it. It is a privilege to be a teacher, to be in that position of trust, to have the opportunity to engage with people where they are and maybe, you know, show them something that they didn't. It's absolutely, I'm so glad to be in this career at this point in time and in my life and in the 21st century, my dude.
That follows up with one of my favorite social media memes that I didn't include here because I didn't know we were going to head this direction.
Okay.
And it's somebody, some random person talking to a teacher and say, "So what do you make?" And then the teacher just looks at him and says, "A difference. I make a difference." Because
Mr. Gucci person on their cell phone and their Rolex and their this and that, what do you make?
Yeah,
I mean, the difference. I'll see you in the square, I suppose. Great. And you do have, of course, some awesome visuals here.
I have some visuals.
Yeah, I like the online actual one about tutoring. You want to speak to that a little bit, my friend?
That is the final findings of my PhD dissertation, where I explored online learning environment technologies. And here's all the stuff that online educators have to do. Whether you know it or not, right? You got to be, you're responsible for the technical milieu, your personality, you're managing student expectations, interacting, how the interactions go with the students and the educators. Like, there's 13 different major factors. And facilitation of learning is only one of them. Right, there's all kinds of stuff. How are you designing the learning? How is the community being developed, right? What is the content milieu? Where are they at with all that? So how are you managing your teaching processes? All of that stuff is there.
That is sick. I can't believe it's taken this long. I can't believe it's taken 2 years for a graphic from your doctorate to make its way into these notes. This is clearly an auspicious occasion, because we love the visuals on this show patently. I love the nuance here. I love how all of these factors that we've been speaking to throughout the show are spoken to here. It's just like, I'm thinking like juggling, like 13 balls in the air. How do you kind of, it's a lot of when I see that graphic, I see a lot of potential. But it's like, wow, we are asking a lot of people. And if they're not properly supported, then what happens, right? That's my kind of takeaway from your graphic there, my friend.
And my buddy Stu was a graphic designer. He was working on his PhD. He's had his PhD now for years. I went to him. This is how naive I am as an online learner, or as an educator and learner. I went to him after I had this designed, and I tried to do it in like that Word art and, you know, all the cruddy, like, let's just do it in Word. And I said, hey, Stu, can you teach me how to use this one particular piece of software? I think it was Adobe Illustrator. And he's like, why? And I said, oh, I've got this and I want to do, he's like, no, I can't teach you. And I'm like, no, man, I'm smart. I can figure it out. He's like, no. He goes, give me this stuff. I'll just do it. And I'm like, no, but I want to learn. He goes, it will take me 10 times longer to teach you than to just do it. So how about I just do it? And then he did a draft of it. And I'm like, oh, no, well, that should be this. That should be that. He goes, perfect. You are the typical person. Client. You didn't know what you wanted. You thought you knew. You told me. And you were wrong. So now let's tidy it up. So I'm like, oh, I love the way you did. Like in the graphic, when people go to take a look at the graphic, the middle piece for the 13 factors that affect educator capabilities, he's created an arrow point out of those just from the shapes of the text, just it's to dope. Focus the it's connection. And I'm like, wow, that's so beautiful. He goes, yeah, I studied. And I learned. It took years to learn how to do that. And you just wanted to do it like in an evening? No. So he was very kind, and he's an amazing guy. So
I think there's quite a bit speaking to the contemporary learning situation just from your anecdote, the story of the production of the visual itself. I mean, don't go looking for shortcuts. Don't take other people's area of practice for granted. Don't assume that anything, the appification of education, it's just like, let's just let the vendor take care of all the e-learning requirements. Like, no, how about you let them keep their grubby mitts off of it and just give me the four or five basic things within the learning environment that I can do myself. You know, if you're not going to fully support a curriculum development unit, if you're not going to curricular, you know, if you're not going to have appropriate teaching supports across the board, then just don't even go into these kind of investments. Just stick with the minimum kit, right? Don't give people hopes or expectations, administrators, that your educators, your frontline staff are going to struggle with and share that struggle with their students, right? Geez, I know we're trying to end on a positive. I think that's positive. I think you got to be.
For sure. So I have a couple of other graphics. One
you do.
I found, it was called Phases of First Year Teachers' Attitudes Towards Teaching.
I love it.
And if after you go to the website, right, it's analogtrope.com/podcast. When you go to that and you'll see this certain graph and how things are working, where anticipation is, where disillusionment is, where reflection is, like all that stuff is so great. And then I've also found the emotional journey for creating anything great. And if you look at those two graphics, they're really close to the same shape.
The line, the waveform is like it's similar. It's very awesome, awesome visuals here. I have to commend my friend. This is first great stuff right here. Yeah.
And I didn't realize we were going to end up with work-life balance and mental health as much as we did, but that is such a key component of what we're doing and how are we preparing educators for that. And not just new educators. Look at the people coming back for year two or people coming back for year 10. It's like it's getting back into the grind. It's getting back into, okay, here's how I have to get ready. Or educators have been around for years and saying, okay, here's your new courses. And start from scratch. Good luck to you. Yeah, we're going to teach that this year instead of whatever you've been teaching. So all of those things are there.
I just really feel pleased that in my situation now, having been away from English teaching, so I was in a position earlier in my career where I was teaching technical writing, business letters, PowerPoint presentations, long and short reports, memoranda, I love that stuff. I love the conciseness. I love the format. I love the realism associated with workplace learning. What I'm doing now is something completely on the opposite side of the spectrum. I'm in a highly international, dynamic community college classroom environment with online capability in a resource-dependent economy locally, as the case may be. So kind of bookending the career so far in two key ways. But now speaking to literature, actually speaking to books and writing and the like. And with that 10-year gap, I'm actually finding myself surprised at like, okay, I'm actually thinking some ideas from that curricular standpoint that I now am getting to implement. So part of it's like, wow, I've been talking about this stuff and giving advice to others for close to 10 years in various capacities. But now I actually get to go, okay, maybe like what's a student created syllabus look like, for instance. I'm getting to do some of this stuff that I've kind of, again, suggested to others or had suggested to me in a seminar or lunch and learn kind of session. It's like awesome just being able to practice this stuff. And so it's like I don't have the world's highest amount of English lit knowledge, you know, formally speaking, but with this curricular stuff, I got quite a bit of stuff. So it's sort of like, how do you make the thing your own? You kind of go with what you have. And so I'm just getting a kick out of like doing a class website. I'm putting up some of my lecture videos as like H5P interactions that other educators could conceivably download, even though I don't know why they would want to. It's just, it's nice to be on the implementation edge of this stuff more than perhaps the theorizing kind of thing that's been going on for me within the context of the show, really, for the past couple of years. So,
yeah.
It's good to be back, Doug. I feel like I rambled our way out of the end here, but I've enjoyed this.
Me too, but I have three last things.
Oh, of course you do. Please, my friend, please.
The word of the podcast is starting. In the notes, I just changed it in the notes. I thought starting was a better word because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about new, whatever the new happens to be. And getting going again, maybe, but you're still starting. The yes. question of the podcast is how can educators get supported with the start of the new school year?
Awesome. Because
that start of the year can be tough. And the phrase of the podcast is work-life balance is a topic of a show. So don't be surprised sometime in the future if work-life balance becomes the whole conversation instead of a sidetrack that we seem to go on, but intentionally went on.
I think it underpins everything that we have been about since the start, even in as much as we were both, when the show conceived of, sort of a lot closer to our time at a shared institution where it was sort of like, okay, you know, let's turn a positive out of our being colleagues at this thing, right? Taking advantage of something that was a challenging situation, respectively for both of us, and, you know, proceeding to make it a positive thing that other people are kind of getting some value out of. To me, that's just a real testament to the persistence of creativity and everything else that we have tried to bring to this show relative to our capabilities. So anybody who's sort of struggling with, am I going to be good enough at this in my role? You really just have to step in, try and play to your strengths. And really just spend as much time as you can being situationally aware and getting to know your students on as many levels as you can right out of the gate. Nothing is in your curriculum is worth passing up the opportunity to engage with your students, start building those relationships immediately, and let that scaffold into the cognitive elements, I think is where I would like to end this. So thanks for the opportunity there to say a little bit at the end, Dr. Doug. Is there anything you wanted to end out on here, bud?
I am looking forward to season three. I think this was a nice start, and I'm looking forward to continuing.
Probably on the weekly, I'm thinking again, which if we can.
That's the hope.
Things to look forward to. Okay, folks, that's it. I'm going to end the recording. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.